Hello and welcome into this edition of the Golf Show Podcast with Rex and Lab. We're a week out from the U.S. Open. Rory McIlroy is getting a final tune-up in this week at the RBC Canadian Open. More on that in just a little bit. Rex, you are finally home after three consecutive weeks on the road. How long was your lawn when you actually got back to Longwood?
Still really long, still really gross. That's my next thing on my to-do list when we get done with this podcast. I think we addressed this when I packed for that particular trip, which turned into three consecutive weeks, a little over 3 weeks, actually. I forgot my pants. I think we talked about this on a previous podcast. I did not pack
pantsless.
Pants. Along the way, I clearly bought pants because you can't make it through 3 weeks. I got to be honest with you. Coming home, flying home yesterday, I looked at myself in the Atlanta airport as I was trying to catch my connection. I was disgusting. I made myself.
You have seen some things.
I've seen some things. I smell. I've got stains that I'm not quite sure what they are. Like, it could be ketchup. Could be coffee. I don't know what this is. Like, I don't have anything clean anymore. And I ran up quite the dry cleaning bill, Fred, just so you know, that one, those two are coming your way. Actually, two dry cleaning bills. But it's just disgusting. Like, I'm looking at the person sitting next to me like, God, this person. Like, as soon as they sat down, I could just imagine them rolling their eyes. Like,
why
do I have to sit next to the homeless person?
Someone said in a Instagram comment that Rex Haggard is the Ben Shapiro of golf. I'm sure that was just an auto-correct mistake, but based on your last 3 weeks, apropos. Before we get to Rory, and I think there's a lot to get to with that conversation, Luke Clanton also making his debut as a PGA Tour full-fledged member this week in Canada as well. You and I were both part of Golf Channel's Golf's Longest Day programming on Monday. You were in Ohio. I was in Georgia. How was your Springfield site?
Not as good as yours. You crushed it. Now, you were so happy. You caught an earlier flight. You didn't have a playoff. You were so happy. You just skated in and skated out. And every time I got the text from you on the chain that we were on, I would just seethe more in jealousy. I think I might have said something mean about Zach Blair once or twice. We had a four-hole playoff that went pretty much till dark. We didn't have any delays. I did like the finish. I would have nothing against Zach Blair. And I certainly hope the first alternate is John Peterson. And it's that John Peterson. The funniest part about Monday for me is we did an early report right out of the gates where we kind of whip around the horn. You had some issues and you looked like you were locked in a library. And then we had a midday hit. And so for the midday hit, I was trying to find whatever was relevant. Like, at that point, you're trying to find someone on the leaderboard. And the leader at that point in time was an amateur by the name of John Peterson. And I was getting so aggravated because every time I Google search trying to find anything, like, I want to do something on the leader, it kept deferring to the former PGA Tour pro who played 96 PGA Tour events, earned a little over $2 million.
Former NCAA champion.
LSU. Like, yeah, real big personality in the game. Certainly liked John, missed John, but that's not the John I was trying to find. I was trying to find whoever this amateur John Peterson is. And then to my surprise, when I actually wandered out on the golf course, it was that John Peterson. He had gotten his amateur status back. He is now a garage door salesman, and he's still a really good golfer. He was in the playoff with Zach Blair and two other players. Zach Blair ended up winning on the fourth hole. John Peterson will be the first alternate, and I'm very hopeful. Usually that first alternate from my site, Springfield, gets in. So I'm very hopeful because it is a really cool story, and it was cool to catch up with him. I'm sorry I whiffed on the midday show because I could have done a solid 75 seconds, which is what we were told to do on John Peterson, because he's such an interesting story. You and I both, I think you did a big feature on him back in the day, certainly outspoken, and he was missed. And so I certainly hope to see him at Oakmont.
Yeah, you would think the first alternate out of Springfield, particularly with how many torn wrist tendons you're going to have in practice rounds at Oakmont, or guys who just walk up the golf course and be like, nah, I think I'm good here. We'll see you at the Open Championship. I think they can go pretty deep on the alternate list. I mean, you're exactly right. That is the smoothest golf's longest day I think I've ever had. First of all, I was just outside Atlanta at Piedmont Driving Club. I'm not sure you've ever played there. It is a magnificent site, very much like Peachtree, probably just a little bit slightly less snooty, I would say, than Peachtree Golf Club, although I'd certainly love to get on that golf course as well. So I flew in very early on Monday morning because we got rid of the 7 to 9 a.m. show. So I got in like 8 o'clock in the morning, had plenty of time, working the range for scoops, trying to figure out exactly who I was going to be talking about. Went on the golf course, toured the golf course, watched some groups come in. Yes, I did have a technical issue. If you saw the little Brady Bunch boxes that they used at the top of every hour, where everyone's just sort of standing and nodding. Yes, I was the only one who was in the men's locker room. We had a live view issue. That's how we transmit all of our live broadcasts. Ended up getting resolved for the midday show, so it was not a huge issue. But no playoff. Will Chandler, a PGA Tour player out of Georgia, hashtag go dogs. He made a birdie on his last hole to save us from what would have been a 3-for-1 playoff. And so it was clean. There's five guys. It took me, I think, the fewest takes ever in order to knock out my wrap at the end of the day. I mean, I was feeling so good.
Not me.
And I think the only thing that I was disappointed about is, look, we're all competitive people. I'm selfish. I'm a little bit greedy. Like, I want to have the best story. You know, we always joke about, like, who can get the guys to cry. You know, I want to have the viral clip.
I was this close on two fronts.
So close.
Man.
But I think when you get to your Springfield site, certainly because it's so PGA Tour dominated, certainly in the Georgia qualifier, like, I feel like we just miss out on some of these offbeat stories. Like, for my site in particular, the Southeast is such a hotbed for golf, and it's a lot of SEC college kids who are, you know, going to be future PGA Tour players. We had a lot of fringe PGA Tour players like Grayson Sigg, Stephen Fisk, Hayden Buckley, all in the mix. Those guys just aren't going to be, you know, as emotional as the dentist who you had out in Washington, or any other player who, you know, in New Jersey or Canada, who, you know, he's fulfilling a lifelong dream. For these SEC college kids, it feels like this is their destiny. And this is their fate, that they're going to be playing in U.S. Opens. For a PGA Tour fringe player, like, yeah, it seems like the next logical step in their career. We just didn't get any of those, even though we almost still got some guys to cry.
And the guy who was medalist at my site, it's a former college player, I believe. He played at Indiana. His name was Grant Hafner. Really interesting dude. He would have taken Great medalist hat. Honors. Huh?
Great hat.
Great hat. Made like a 70-footer on the last green. Quite the celebration. Like, it was all pretty good. I was this close to getting him to cry. Couldn't get him over the hump. I think actually Kira Kay with the dentist probably won. I think I watched that interview. Seemed very emotional. And then the other one was in this kid has qualified almost every year at the Springfield side. He's a former Ohio State kid, Max Moldovan. And it was funny because 2 years ago he lost in a playoff and in darkness. And he was going to be the first alternate. And I was confident then, just as I was confident on Monday, that John Peterson would probably get in. I didn't tell Max that before the interview because I was trying to like, oh, this must just kill you that you're not getting in the open. Is that it? And so this time around, Max was a little bit more relaxed. He was still emotional. Cool stories. You're right. But my site, certainly Todd Lewis's site in Columbus, your site, the hotbed in the Southeast. Yeah, those are gravitated towards more sort of aspiring professionals, guys who are just trying to break through. Yeah, the better stories, I tend to agree with you. They come from New Jersey. They come from Canada. Certainly what happened in Washington was really cool.
I want to say, since this is a podcast on Golf Channel, we tend to be pretty diehard. Keep an eye out for this kid named Mason Howell. He's the 17-year-old rising high school senior. He's going to Georgia in the fall of 2026. This dude is good. It's like if Harris English and Davis Thompson had a baby. Like, he sort of looks like Davis Thompson, but he has the game like Harris English. He's got a ton of firepower. I mean, the kid shot bogey-free rounds of 63-63 at the age of 17. I know he was matched by Jackson Buchanan, who's also a really good player, just finished up his college career at Illinois. They were six shots better than anyone else in this qualifier. Like, in this qualifier, again, had PGA Tour players, had hotshot college kids. Like, I know a lot of people scoffed at it, said the golf course must have been too easy. Like, he's 17 years old. It's incredible. It's another example, I think, of how deep junior golf is. I know we talked about Charlie Woods on the Sunday show, but like Miles Russell, Blades Brown
barely
playing junior
qualify.
Golf right now. I mean, Tyler Watts, the best and the brightest are certainly coming through the junior ranks right now. Very exciting. All right, let's move on to the professional ranks in the PGA Tour event this week in Canada. Rory McIlroy looking for his third win in Canada, and what actually would be the 30th PGA Tour title of his career. On Wednesday, just finished up his press conference just outside Toronto. It's the first time we've heard from him, Rex, since his no-show at the PGA Championship, although he finished as the top 45. We did not actually hear from Rory after his press conference on Tuesday at Quail Hollow. What'd you take away from what he had to say with the media, and sort of what are you anticipating from Rory this week?
I think it was probably pretty much what we expected when it comes to going back to the PGA Championship, his decisions not to talk to the media after each of the four rounds. We knew he was aggravated that his driver had been deemed non-conforming. And it turns out he was aggravated because the story got out. It is interesting that he was more aggravated that the story got out and it didn't necessarily get out that Scottie Scheffler's driver also was deemed non-conforming. Although I would say that seems like you're splitting hairs because it did eventually come out. Like, we learned that Scottie Scheffler's driver, and Scottie addressed it. And I would argue that the way in which Scottie addressed it probably made it a much easier pill for many, many people to swallow, because he explained it in a way that everyone seemed to understand that, yes, it was deemed non-conforming. I've been using it for a year. That's usually the shelf life on one of these drivers based on how hard we swing it and how often we swing it. When you're pounding the club face time and time again, eventually all of them are going to be deemed non-conforming. I understand his level of aggravation. I still keep going back to, had he stood in front of a microphone at Quail Hollow and had this explanation, it would have probably gone the same way that Scottie Scheffler's conversation went, that everyone would have understood. Otherwise, you left the void to be filled by people who don't understand the system, don't understand that these drivers will all be eventually deemed non-conforming. If they're not, you've got the wrong driver. I was teasing last week with one of the equipment reps about, would you ever, the way these are sort of measured, it's not necessarily a number. It is a number, but you're either green, you're yellow, which would clearly be right in the middle, right on the line, or you're red, you're deemed non-conforming. My question to two equipment reps last week at Mirrorfield Village was, would you ever give a green driver to a tour player? And absolutely not. We don't have one in the truck. Like, there would be no reason to do that, because he'd hit it once. He'd look at the numbers and be like, no, thanks. That's not the one I want at all. They have no interest in giving up distance. That's not on anyone's dance card. And so I get that. There were some other reasons why he chose not to talk to the media. Again, I'm not going to go down this avenue that they have to. I just think it was disappointing.
Yeah, when it comes to the driver stuff, Rory said that he knew that Scottie's driver had failed on Monday, and that he didn't feel like it was his responsibility to offer that information, which I think is probably correct. Rory was pissed off, to use his words, because he said that this was supposed to be a confidential testing, and it got leaked by two separate media members without his knowledge prior. And so Rory was annoyed at that process, and he said he didn't want to go in front of the media then after his second round, which is when it leaked, and say something that he regretted, whether he was, you know, needing to protect Scottie Scheffler and his failed driver test, needing to protect TaylorMade, needing to protect the USGA, PGA of America, whoever it was going to be. He just didn't want to have to face the music at that point in the mindset that he was having. So I totally understand that. Would he have been better off explaining that probably a day later? Yeah. I think on Saturday, it would have made a lot of sense. Rory's rationale for why he did not talk to the media sort of had to do with just logistics, where on Thursday, he didn't play well. He wanted to go practice. On Friday, the driver issue came out. He also finished late. He said he wanted to get home before Poppy went to bed. On Saturday, that was the day, remember, he was supposed to be one of the first groups off, ended up going off the backside, one of the last groups off, said it was just a long day, he was tired and wanted to go back to his house. And on Sunday, he was out of contention at the PGA Championship. Looks like his rival, Scottie Scheffler, was going to win another major championship and just wanted to get home to South Florida. This does bring up, Rex, I think, the possibility of a larger conversation of what does a professional golfer owe the media. It's something that we've been talking about for the last couple of months, thanks to Colin Morikawa when he stiff-armed the media after Bay Hill. Rory said that from a responsibility standpoint, he understands that, but he believes that it should be a two-way street, and that if PGA Tour players wanted to, they could completely bypass any and all media that were there on site to cover it and just go onto their phones and record a 90-second video to talk about their rounds, talk about anything that else that happened, post it on Instagram or Twitter, and off they went. And that would be sort of their connecting with the fans. That, of course, is the point of our job, is it not? We're supposed to be the liaison, the proxy between PGA Tour players and golf fans in general. So in his opinion, there needs to be a two-way street of understanding where sometimes these guys don't want to talk after a round, while also understanding it's an obligation. Sponsors have the sponsors are anticipating that they're going to be in front of their signage and talking to the media that are ensemble as well, and also the fans. Until there is something concrete, until there is something mandatory in the PGA Tour regulations, Roy said this is just going to be the way of life on the PGA Tour and the media who cover it.
And let's be clear, and I think you kind of read into this, so I do want to unpack this a little bit. The way I understood your explanation following Quail Hollow, you felt as if Rory was sending a message that maybe we should consider some sort of policy, correct?
Yes. Yes, correct. Okay.
I don't know that to be true. Certainly, this is something that Rory has thought about. Certainly, it's something the PGA Tour has thought about. And I can say in conversations with the tour since this happened, I tend to be in agreement with those in the communications department that have the same concerns that you and I in the media have, that when you have a player of Rory McIlroy's stature that skips all 4 days, it's not great. But the bigger issue here is it sets a standard for every other player on the PGA Tour. The other 155 players at Quail Hollow were looking and saying to themselves, well, if that guy isn't going to do it, then why in the world would I talk to the media after a round? It makes no sense. That is disturbing. That's concerning for all of us in the media. The flip side of that would be what you're alluding to, the idea that maybe, like every other sport, most sports, maybe the PGA Tour should have a policy that demands players have media availability after each round. I tend to agree with some of the folks at the PGA Tour who I've discussed this with, that that would be counterproductive. Because what you could possibly end up with in that situation is even more animosity, which this cropped up from the Colin Morikawa issue, going from Bay Hill to the Players' Championship and everything that happened there. You could end up with the Marshawn Lynch situation, where now you have players who will sit and stand in front of the camera and either not say anything at all or babble nonsense like he famously did back in the day to avoid the fines. I don't think that's productive at all. The system that the PGA Tour has had for decades has worked well. We now have one player that seems like he wants to have an issue with this and make some sort of a statement. I'm still not 100% sure what his statement is, because I'm not quite sure you're reading the room correctly on this.
So I don't necessarily think that Rory is trying to make a stand, but I think he's doing so unintentionally at this point. Here's his exact quote on Wednesday, where, quote, if they want to make it mandatory, talking about PGA Tour players having to talk to the media, that's fine. But in our rules, it's not. And until the day that's written into the regulations, you're going to have guys skip from time to time. And that's well within our...
That's fine.
I mean, it's hard to quibble with what he's saying there. Is Roy McIlroy pushing for this to be legislated in PGA Tour regulations? I would say no. I don't think he's. No,
I don't think he is.
I don't think he's vocally supporting that move. But I also don't think he's necessarily opposed to it either. And I think he's unintentionally making a stand where, if it becomes the norm, if more players do follow suit, if PGA Tour executives start hearing from sponsors or other partners that this is becoming an issue, then yeah, I think we could go back and look at this moment in time and be like, yep, this is what happened, whether it was Kyle Morikawa, whether it was Shane Lowry voicing support for an idea of like a 15 to 30 minute cool off period, whether it was Rory McIlroy not talking to the media for all 4 days at the PGA Championship. I do think that this is sort of a seminal moment in time as it comes to athlete and media relations. Sausage fingers up, please do go ahead.
This goes back to our conversation on Sunday night, and I'm still giggling about sort of the philosophy when it comes to mud balls on the PGA Tour. And the way it was explained to me is they will allow preferred lives, live clean in place, under extreme mud balls. That's every single day, not 1 or 2 days of the week, which I still makes me laugh. I don't know why that they've come up with a name for it. It applies to this situation as well. In Rory's parlance, it would be extreme avoidance versus not extreme avoidance. So if you avoid the media once or twice over the course of the week, that's fine. But if you do it every day, like, I don't know, someone may have done or may not have done at Quail Hollow, that seems like it's extreme avoidance, and we should probably avoid that.
And as media members, I think we need to be self-aware, right? Like, if Rory shoots 71 in the opening round of the RBC Canadian Open, do you really need to hear from him? I would argue no.
No.
I think you'd be better off waiting until if or when he plays well, waiting to the end of the week. Like, I don't think it's necessary to put him in front of a microphone all 4 days, even if he's not necessarily a part of the conversation of the tournament. That's where I think, to his point, there should be a two-way street or a level of understanding among media members as well that, yes, would it be nice to have a Rory McIlroy headline on our homepage and have fresh Rory McIlroy quotes? Certainly. Would it actually be counterproductive? Yeah. I also think for the PGA Tour's sake, it would be really hard to legislate mandatory participation for players and media members. If we mentioned Harris English earlier, if Harris English is 35th at the RBC Canadian Open, does he have to talk to the media? How will he know that the media wants to talk to him? Does he need to just make himself available for 5 minutes after his round if anyone wants to? Do you have to sort of create the situation where you've covered a couple Olympics now where you have sort of the gauntlet that these guys have to go through even after the round if no one wants to talk to them? Basically building that little template at every single PGA Tour stop just so they can sort of check the box saying, yes, this was mandatory and no one wanted to talk to them. I think it's really difficult to legislate for these guys over the course of a 45-event PGA Tour schedule. But again, I think it's worth the conversation.
And to your point, there's a lot of dancing that goes on behind the scenes when it comes to the media, at least on the TV side. So to give you an example, to go back to Fort Worth and the Colonial, where I was the reporter that week. And you always, with Scotty being in the field, being the primary example, you always want to be cognizant of, yes, we could probably ask for Scotty after every single round. But the conversation with the producers are, oh, do we really want to do this on a Friday after he shot 71 versus what we may need slash want on a Saturday or Sunday? So yes, to your point, I think most media members, whether they be TV or otherwise, are cognizant of the idea that this is a give and take. Like, there was a time when Tiger Woods talked after every single round. I don't think that's the expectation anymore.
No, nor should it be in this current environment. And a lot of fans will just say, well, stop talking about him. If Rory doesn't want to talk, you know, just focus on somebody else. But there was a moment in Rory McIlroy's press conference on Wednesday where he served a reminder of why it's so important to get him in front of a microphone and to get his thoughts on things. Because Adam Stanley, our friend of the podcast, great Canadian golf writer, asked him, you know, what are you chasing at this point? You just accomplished the career Grand Slam. You know, what are you chasing at this point? And Rory's response was, I don't know that I'm chasing anything. And in fact, you know, having a couple weeks off after the PGA Championship, I found it a little bit tougher to grind on the range for 3 or 4 hours because you just had this significant event in your life, something that you have been dedicating your entire life to achieving with the career Grand Slam. It's a little bit hard to find the motivation to get back on the horse and go again. That is a phenomenal quote. That is phenomenal insight. That really lets us know what Rory McIlroy is feeling at this point in time on June 4th with two major championships to go, with the Ryder Cup on deck a couple of months after that. There is so much yet to play for this PGA Tour season, and he is admitting publicly that it's really difficult for him right now to find some level of motivation. That's terrific, and you would only get that if Rory McIlroy is in front of the microphone. That's why I think he's such a crucial figure for the PGA Tour. That's why I think this conversation is worth having, because if you don't have that, I think we're poorer as golf media. We're poorer as golf observers. Golf fans don't quite understand these players as well. It makes them more human. And I think that's why we're tuning in the first place.
I don't know that there's been an athlete, at least since I've covered the PGA Tour, who is as honest when it comes to what's going on in his life, what's going on in his own head, as Rory McIlroy, sometimes to his detriment. Sometimes he has admitted in the past that maybe I need to keep some things to myself. I guess Jordan Spieth would be a very close second, because both of them seem just to, as if they're shot full of sodium pentothal every time you put a microphone in front of them. And that's a good thing for us. We'd like to do storytelling. to that point, that was a phenomenal answer, because the entire narrative ever since he won on that glorious Sunday at Augusta National is, what's next? What do you really do when you get to the top of the mountain? I don't anticipate Rory McIlroy following David Duval's lead, where David Duval got the number one in the world, won the Open Championship, won his first major, and realized, nah, that was a lot of work for nothing. I don't imagine that that's going to be the case with Rory, but a hangover, that's not only expected, I think it was obvious that there was going to be a few weeks afterwards where you're going to struggle a little bit. It'll be telling by the time we get to the end of the season. It's not going to happen after the U.S. Open or the Open Championship or even the Ryder Cup. But as we start to have these conversations in December, and if the hangover has lasted, then I think it is an interesting conversation. That what happens when you get to the top of the mountain professionally? I now know what that feels like. And I got to tell you, it's difficult for me to come to work sometimes.
I mean, I remember the hangover that I had.
Sure. Yeah, right there.
The rest of 2020.
Mine's going to go right here.
That's a great spot for it, just outside the view of the camera.
Sure.
Just as mine is. Rory McIlroy, by the way, a two-time winner at the RBC Canadian Open. First time they played this golf course at TPC Toronto. He described it, right? So it is a TPC venue. A, quote, typical TPC setup. Said it, quote, could be a good test. By the end of the week, it does not seem like TPC Toronto is going to be winning any architectural awards by Golf Digest. It's still going to serve as a tune-up for next week's U.S. Open at one of the most difficult golf courses, if not the most difficult golf course on the planet. Another player, Rex, who I think much will be of expected, not just this week, but for the rest of 2025, is Luke Clanton, who's the second player to get through the PGA Tour University Accelerator Program, which awards points for high amateur finishes, either in amateur events and college events, but also the PGA Tour. He just finished his junior season at Florida State. This was a player who you might recall burst onto the scene last summer, had four top 10 finishes, runner-up finishes at the Deer, runner-up finish at the RSM Classic as well. What are your expectations as now Luke Clanton joins the play-for-play set?
I think the potential is phenomenal. Before I get to that, though, we have a tendency in golf media, not just on this podcast, of only looking at the negative things that the PGA Tour does. Primary example was last week's podcast when we picked apart the Tour Championship and all the changes. And I think I used Lucas Glover's line that if you change something 17 times, you've probably built a bad golf course. And so it's easy to always throw those slings and arrows in the PGA Tour's direction. I will say that this is one of the most brilliant moments in the PGA Tour history in 2+ decades of covering the circuit, because what they've created with PGA Tour U and Accelerated is the pathway that I think everyone has always wanted and needed, which was obvious. And there are going to be pitfalls here. I don't think Luke Clanton is going to be one of them. You look at the things that he does well, and he has the makeup. He has the bones of a phenomenal PGA Tour player. There are still some things that I'm sure he has to learn, but I was at the RSM Classic and just blown away with how he didn't seem to have any holes in his game. Yes, he could probably clean up something here or there, but when you talk to Trey Jones, his coach at Florida State, and you ask him point blank, is there anything he needs to get better at to being the PGA Tour? Trey Jones, who was also Brooks Koepka's coach at Florida State, so he knows a thing or two about what makes a good PGA Tour player, and he struggles to come up with something specifically, that's probably going to be the five-tool player that's going to last on the PGA Tour. I'm not saying he's going to come out and do a Jordan Spieth or a Scottie Scheffler right this season. There is going to be a learning curve involved here, but that learning curve has gotten so much smaller. And I just think we always gloss over the things the tour does well, and this is one of them.
And a lot of people keep pointing to the fact that LIV Golf came around, and all of a sudden they could, and they have in some instances poached some
they
of
did
this
it
young,
this week.
This young talent that could have been. We're going to get to Jose Ballester, the 2024 U.S. Amateur champion, played the Masters, just snagged him for Sergio Garcia's Fireballs squad. But this had been in the works. PGA Tour University had long before. It was actually announced and implemented before LIV Golf came around as well. So I do think that's important to point out as well. As it relates to Luke Clanton, David Ford, Gordon Sargent, who was the first player to advance to this accelerated program, they all have status now on the PGA Tour through the end of the 2026 season. And I think that's important to point out because it allows these guys now to get settled and have a transition period from elite high-level amateur and college golf to the professional ranks. typically before PGA Tour University Accelerator Program came around, if you were a hotshot Luke Clanton, right, and you wanted to turn pro, similar to what a John Rahm faced, similar to what a Jordan Spieth faced, they had this race for 7 unrestricted sponsor exemptions that they would have as soon as the college season ended. And they're maximizing their schedule to make sure they got enough. It would be the equivalent of number 125 in the FedEx Cup points list for non-member points. And they're basically playing almost every single week to try and get the equivalent of that 125. Sometimes they do it in the case of a Spieth or a Rahm. Sometimes they don't. And they're then relegated to the Korn Ferry Tour, mini tours, and they have to work their way up that way. This is such a better system. And I think it will prove to be a greater predictor of future success because you're giving these guys a little bit of a runway. It isn't just a stress fest in the summer where they're learning all of these things for the first time, what it's like to be a professional, what it's like to travel every single week, what it's like to compete against the world's best players, what it's like to have the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday in anticipation of a tournament, what you're supposed to do throughout tournament rounds, after the round, recovery, like all of these things you're learning in real time. Now, these top players, whether it's Gordon Sargeant, whether it's David Ford, whether it's Luke Clanton, they now actually have a year and a half to get their footing as PGA Tour players. And I think that's really, I think that's, first of all, it's rewarding their amateur success, which I think is important. But I also think it's allowing them to find their footing more naturally, which I think will, in as a result, produce better, more consistent, longer lasting careers.
You brought up Gordon Sargeant, and you cover obviously the college game much better than anyone. You are a college expert at Golf Channel. And I am curious about, not sure why that created such a laugh out of you. I am curious about Gordon Sargeant because I've heard the rumblings that pretty much ever since he got his PGA Tour card that he has struggled at Vanderbilt. And I'm sure it's not as a result of earning your PGA Tour card, but there is a concern on that level that if you're going to create this pathway, that you could also create pressure.
I mean, you certainly could. I mean, Gordon Sargeant has completely lost his game. Couldn't even crack the starting five for Vanderbilt this year for the postseason. As a result, they did not make it all the way to match play, which, you know, a couple years ago would have seemed unthinkable after Gordon Sargeant was the NCAA champion as a freshman with the Commodores. I understand that, but at least if you're Gordon Sargeant now, and he just shot 80 in the first round of US Open qualifying, I think expectations for him are much lower. At least now he has a little bit of a runway, right, to work his way out of it, as opposed to if in the old format, he now had the 7 sponsor exemptions, in all likelihood, he would not maximize those opportunities. And then where do you go? You know, are you conditional status on the Korn Ferry Tour? Are you playing in Canada? You know, he's just sort of lost. This way, he's already proven his potential. You know, that's why this system exists, because you're earning points because of your world amateur ranking. You're earning points because of some amateur or college events that you have won. He's already proven himself in some sense. Now, at least he's biding himself time to sort of work through it. I had an interview to talk to Jackson Koivun, who just wrapped up his sophomore season at Auburn. He has actually, Rex, already earned his PGA Tour card in 2 seasons at Auburn, which would have been unthinkable once this program actually came out. He has already announced that he's going to defer that membership until at least after his junior season at Auburn. And so he's going back to college with the knowledge that whenever he wants, he can take up PGA Tour membership. I think that's really powerful. He can get all of his life, his responsibilities, his equipment contracts, his agency contracts. He knows where he could map out a schedule that he's going to have once he turns pro, potentially at the end of his junior season. I think you look at that conversely to what's happened with Nick Dunlap and the amount of conversations we've had about Nick Dunlap after the whirlwind Amex win that he had in 2024, his life changing in an instant overnight. Which pathway is more preferable? I would argue it's Jackson Koivun's. Will it be more successful? We're going to have to wait 5 or 10 years to find out. But I think that is a better way to start your PGA Tour career and to potentially have a longer lasting PGA Tour career than everything happening at spur of the moment, being really stressed and trying to maximize those few opportunities when they come.
in the hierarchy of hot takes, and you and I both are guilty of having bad hot takes on numerous occasions, I still don't know where my take on Nick Dunlap and your take. In the heat of the moment, it was Sunday night at the American Express after he had won. I was in the desert, so I was covering the event, and I understood where you were coming from. You did not. Actually, you didn't go to the mat with the idea that maybe he should just go back to Alabama, but you suggested it. And I thought it was ridiculous because of what he had just given himself the opportunity to do. It was a once in a lifetime opportunity. This was just not a normal win out of nowhere. This is the first signature event season. And now suddenly he went from zero to qualified for every signature event. It was an opportunity that I felt like you simply cannot pass up, whether or not if he's ready or not, you're never going to get this opportunity again. So take advantage of it. Now, with hindsight, he struggled mightily the rest of the year. He ended up winning for the second time later that season in the fall. And so I think there is some justification there, but it is an interesting conversation.
I mean, realistically, logistically, of course he was going to have to take up membership. The perks are too good. I sort of equate it to other sports where you look at like a Cooper Flagg, right, who had this incredible season at Duke. He knows he is going to be the number one pick in the NBA draft. He plays out his college season through the end of March. He doesn't have to play pro ball, Rex, at least for games that count, that matter, until what, October? And so he basically has a 6-month runway to get his life in order, to understand what it's like to be a professional before he actually hits the ground running. If you're a Nick Dunlap or a PGA Tour player, you know, it's a rare instance, but his life changed overnight and all of a sudden he had to become a professional. All of a sudden, at the NCAA championship, these other hotshot college players now have to learn how to be a PGA Tour player. There is no grace period in pro golf as there is in a basketball or a baseball just because of how the seasons work. That is why I think it would have been beneficial for Nick Dunlap. Obviously, he's a 2-time winner on the PGA Tour. I know he's going through a rough patch right now with the driver yips. I'm sure the talent will overcome and he'll be fine. He has a runway to do so with the 2-year exemption. However, I just think it's an interesting conversation and it's just further proof of how different professional golf is than a lot of other sports. All right. That is going to do it for this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Av. Rex and Lath, that is my name. Rex and I'll be back on Sunday night, not for a full 52-minute edition that is made for linear television. We're getting bumped for like PGA Tour and PGA Tour Champions highlights in the morning. And then our buddy Gary Williams and Five Clubs will have a 2-hour show live from Oakmont leading into live from the US Open, which you and I will both be on Monday at the US Open. But fear not, Rex and I will be still back on Sunday night to do a recap of the RBC Canadian Open, look ahead to the US Open, and whatever else comes up. It'll just be live on YouTube. All right. In the meantime, you guys are the drill. NBCSports.com/golf for all the latest news, notes, and updates. Thanks for listening. Thanks for the support. We'll talk to you guys on Sunday night.
Golf Channel's college expert.